I would like to extend the greeting of the Oakland Symphony Orchestra Association to the members of the press who have been so helpful to us, and offer our greetings to them. Also, the benefactors and patrons of the symphony and our very good friends. I'm always worried when I walk into a room and find the decorations and carnations, because many of you know that I frequently wear one, and I very carefully noted that there are no white carnations, so obviously I did not snitch this one from any other tables. I am certainly not the highlight of our evening, but I would like to mention to you that I have the privilege tonight of introducing our chairman of the board. Dirty White. I would like to introduce to you the chairman of the board. Certainly knows no introduction. Mr. Kaiser is well known to all of you, and I think that he is certainly the manifestation of his philosophy, which is that thank you. In order to enjoy such cultural aspects that we have and our standard of living, as you well know, his philosophy is to participate. And at the top of our letterhead, you find the name Edgar Kaiser, and it is not a showcase, it is not a show letterhead. He probably is one of the most active members in your association. So he definitely is a participating chairman of the board and not window dressing. And with that, I should like to introduce our host, Mr. Edgar Kaiser, who will in turn introduce our honored guest. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. He laid it on just a little bit thick. I appreciate the flattery. There are few people, Alan, associated with this organization who hold my hand rather tightly and have been helping. Let me explain this situation this evening, a press conference and a reception. It's a little bit unusual. What actually happened was this. When Gary told us that Mr. Benny had accepted, then we began to give some thought as to what to do about the program. So it was finally decided that Mrs. Kaiser and I would like very much to have the benefactors and the patrons join us here for dinner after the concert on Wednesday evening. We thought this would work out fine. Looking at the past history of support of Symphony, we'd probably have 200 or 300 people here. So we started out to do this. Well, we found out, as a result of both Gary and Mr. Benny, that we had over 500. Well, that meant we were going to have 1,000. Well, we said we can't have 1,000 people for dinner, and we can't have 1,000 meeting Mr. Benny. So we decided to open the cafeteria downstairs after the concert, which we were doing, and you're all most welcome to come, and we do expect some 800 to 1,000. Then the question was, how do you really have people who have been very substantial supporters, as you have, meet Mr. Benny? So we decided, why not join the press conference? So you are the select few, and we just had to draw the line. And we're delighted to have you here to meet Jack. Now, I'd like to ask Gary to say a few words, and before Gary does, let me say this to you about Gary. Gary, as you know, and many of you hear much better than I, is not only a fine leader, but he's a stimulator. The people in this orchestra of his look to him. He's a leader. He is also a good salesman. He's good press relations. Gary is dedicated to his job. He's a fine fellow. And it's been a pleasure to work with you, Gary. Gary Samuels.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm not here to make a speech at all because this is not my show, this is Mr. Benny's show. But I want to tell you how very, very grateful we are for Mr. Benny to have come here and to be the cause for what will probably be the most substantial fundraising effort that this symphony has ever undertaken. And not only undertaken in terms of dollars, but this whole project has only been underway for 8 weeks, and if all goes well, we will probably cover 99%, if not more, of our entire deficit for this season due to the efforts of our workers, but mostly, I think, due to the presence of a gentleman, an artist whom I esteem tremendously, Mr. Benny.
Mr. Kaiser said you were all going to eat in the cafeteria. And he was trying to figure out a way that you'd all meet me, so evidently I'm going to serve. He's got that all figured out, I think, yeah.
Saved one person.
Yeah. Now, Gary here gives me all the credit for this big night that we are actually going to have, which they're taking in a lot of money. I'll tell you how much in comparison to many concerts that we give. So therefore, I don't deserve the credit that the people do who really have participated and bought all of these tickets at high prices. You know, you'd be surprised how in many places they're frightened to ask for that kind of money, you know. And I told them they don't have to be. Now, if I were a great violinist, they would have to be frightened. But when you play like I do, they're going to come out of curiosity, you know. And I can't convince them of this. Now, I would like to say, and I think Mr. Kaiser and Gary and all of you would like to hear this, I have given concerts for 8 years, and excluding one for in Toronto, we gave for Israel Bonds, which they took in over $1 million that night, and also one that we gave in Hartford about 2 years ago to build a college, in which Fuller, of the Fuller Brush Company, he gave $400,000 if I would appear in concert and to have the city meet it, that figure, and they met it with $438,000, which was $838,000 in this one night. But here, I really believe they're going to take in more money than any concert I have ever given for the musicians or the pension fund. Now, I really mean that. Now, we took in about half of this amount in Portland, and it was jammed. You couldn't get a seat. Much, much bigger house than we're going to play here. Jammed, but they're afraid. And you know, people that'll give $50 will give $100. That's the funny part of it. And the tough seats to sell are not the $100 seats. We try to explain it to them. They're not hard to sell, nor the seats that are $3. The tough ones to sell are the 20 and 10s. They don't want to sit there, you know. And so we try to explain this. We try to explain this to everybody, and they get frightened, and they're afraid to do it. So that's why I think this is, I'm looking forward so much to this night. And I was going to say something a little while ago that I think is kind of humorous about what happened. You know, I mentioned giving this concert in Hartford, where we took in $838,000. And I got to tell you how this started. I was in London appearing at a Royal Command performance. I was invited to fly there and appear for the Royal Command performance for the royal family. So I was there for a week. And suddenly I get a call from Isaac Stern, this great violinist. And there were a lot of people in the room with me, and I explained to him what what he asked me to do, and we all laughed, and Isaac couldn't understand why we were laughing. Now, this is what Isaac Stern said to me. Now, you got to remember, here is the world's greatest violinist, or certainly, if you mention the three great violinists of the world, you have to mention Isaac Stern. Now, he calls me. He said, Jack, I had to call you. I knew you were in London, and he's my closest friend in the music world. And he says, I just got a call from Hartford, Connecticut, in which they said, Isaac, we know that you know Jack Benny very, very well. Now, if you can get Benny to come to Hartford and give a concert, we can take in almost $1 million. Now, I went into convulsions, and he couldn't understand why. He said, Jack, what are you laughing at? I said, well, if you don't get the humor of this, you're nuts. Here you are, the world's greatest violinist, and they're asking you if they can get me, they'll take in $1 million. Then he realized how funny it was, you know. But that's the way that actually happened. But these concerts... And, you know, I can almost tell you ahead of time, and I don't have to be frightened about it, that really it's a terrific night with a lot of laughs. And the reason I can say that is because it never varies. You know, it goes about exactly the same no matter where I give the concerts, just about the same way, whether I play good, bad, or lousy. I shouldn't have even put good in there. I should have just put bad or lousy, you know. But I actually try to play. This is what's not only humorous, but it's almost pathetic. That I try to play so good and that I actually think I'm such a good violinist. And the orchestra goes along with it, and they try to help me, and the audience hollers, bravo, you know, after some lousy classical number that I played. And the critics, the music critics, and everybody go along with it, you know. And they say funny things. In fact, I gave a concert in Pittsburgh recently, and the music critic used to be in the orchestra. And the next day, I pick up the paper, and I knew this critic, and he wrote the most glowing review of this concert. It was this long, in about two columns, about how wonderful, what a wonderful evening it was. And then down at the finish, he said, sooner or later, I have to tell you that Jack is not the world's greatest violinist. He was afraid he was making too much out of this, you know? Which I thought was so funny. And they review them a lot like that, you know. One says, they say things like Heifetz, Jack holds the violin under his chin. And that's about as much as they make out of it, you know. But if people knew, now Heifetz actually thinks, you know, that I can play better than I do. He thinks that I just put this on, you see. And I try to explain to him that I can't, that I am really a frustrated violinist. If I could become, if by some miracle, overnight, if there was such a thing as a miracle, where I could become one of the world's greatest violinists, I would give up comedy tomorrow. You know? But I better stick to what I'm doing, this I can tell you. In fact, Mr. Piatigorsky, the great cellist, said to me one day, he said, you know, Jack, you're in the most enviable position of anybody who gives concerts. I said, why? He said, well, he said, you see, we, meaning himself, Heifetz, Isaac Stern, Leonard Rose, all of these great artists, he says, we don't dare make one mistake. He says, you can make 500 mistakes, and you better make them. This gives you a pretty good description of the kind of a show. And then I talk for about 10, 15 minutes out there, because I know they want to hear a little of that. And when we get the real concert-going audiences, then I realize how much better they are, even for laughter, the usual theaters we play or the television shows that we do. You can't get those kind of laughs. You can only get them in concert halls with those kind of audiences. And even though I've been doing this for about 8 years, I'll tell you something. You know, everybody gives me, you know, Harry Truman, President Harry Truman is the one that started me on this idea of doing it for the musicians. What happened was I had been giving concerts the first year. Am I talking too long or is this all right? Well, I've been giving, I gave concerts for a year for different charities, City of Hope, Israel Bonds, and all kinds of different charities. And finally, Mr. Truman and I are very, very good friends. So one day in Los Angeles, we were over at Ed Pauley's house for a breakfast. And Mr. Truman came over to me and he said, Jack, he says, you know, you could do me a great favor. You know, I'm opening up my library in Independence, Missouri. And I wish you could talk about it. I love this project so, and I'm so interested in it. I wish you could talk about it on your program. Can you mention it occasionally? So I said, well, Mr. President, I'll be glad to do it, and I'll tell you what else I'll do. If you'd like, I'll come to Kansas City and give a concert for the opening of your library. He said, that would be wonderful. Then, about 2 months before the concert, he called me. And he said, Jack, would you mind? I don't actually need the money right now for the library, but boy, we have an orchestra in Kansas City who needs it badly. Funny that I hadn't thought of this before. He said, would you mind giving a concert and help the orchestra? You can really get them out of a hole. So I said, gee, Mr. President, I'd love to do that. I hate to tell you this, but I'd almost rather do it for the orchestra because it has a greater significance than a fellow like myself who just fiddles to give money to help all these musicians because I love music. He said, well, that'll be wonderful, and I'll run it for you, you see, which he did. And so then when I got to Kansas City and I did the first one for the musicians, I said, you know, Mr. Truman, you started something for me, and this was about 6-7 years ago. I said, every concert I give now will be done either for the sustaining the orchestra or for their pension fund or for whatever the orchestra needs the money for. This is the only way I'll give concerts, and I stuck right to it, except the one I mentioned in Hartford was done for a musical college. So that's practically, you know, the same thing. So, oh, then I got to tell you something funny. Then I thought, now I wanted Mr. Truman to be a guest on my television show. See? So I thought, gee, this is a good time to take advantage of it now because I just did him a favor. And even though he was a close friend of mine, I thought to myself, how can I ask a president or an ex-president, which of course he was, how can I ask, no matter what a close friend he is of mine, and we've really been very good. He's the closest friend I have in politics, and I think, no, really. He really is, and the late, God rest his soul, John Kennedy was the second closest. I don't care if you're a Republican or not, are you? I don't know. But anyway, I'm neither, you know. I'm neither a Republican or a Democrat. I'm the guy they try to grab in the middle, you know? But I thought I'd take advantage of this, and I thought I'd ask Mr. Truman to come on my show. And then I got frightened, because as I said, how can I ask a president to come on a show and do a comedy half hour with me, even if we do it from his library, which I had intended to do. So I didn't ask him when I was there. So I got home, and I said to my wife, because I told her I was going to do it, and so my wife said, well, did you ask him? I said, no, I was afraid to. She says, well, why don't you call him and ask him? Now, he's very close to you, you're very close to him. All he can say is no, and he'll give you a very good reason. He'll be very nice about it, and But I said, oh, he'll get a million letters from all the Democrats telling him not to do this, go on a comedy show. She says, ask him, will you please? So I was frightened. I was very, very nervous. But anyway, I called him up, and I said, Mr. Truman, this is Jack, Jack Benny. Oh, he says, hello, Jack. It was so nice of you what you did for our orchestra with the concert and everything. I said, thank you. And then I said, Mr. Truman, I said, I'm going to ask a favor of you. I said, would you like to be a guest on my television show? He says, certainly, Jack, I'd love to. And I was so nervous, I said, why not? Anyway, I got him on, and we had a darn good show. We did it from his library. Oh, and he kept saying to me, you know, all the time we were rehearsing, I said, you know, I was so frightened. I said, you know, Mr. Truman, this is going to be in real good taste. He said, I know you're in good taste, Jack. Don't worry about it. So he says, I said, I'm going to keep this very dignified. And I kept saying it so much that finally even Mr. Truman says, Jack, he says, you know, you do a comedy show. Now, don't have it so dignified that we don't get any laughs. And then we got, then last year, now that I wasn't afraid to ask him, I asked Billy Graham to come on. And he said yes. And we got screams with Billy Graham, you know, and didn't mind it. So, and they get letters protesting this, you see, but after a while people forget about it. And I think if you keep things in good taste, just like, strangely enough, when I give these, not strangely enough, but it should be done this way. When I give these concerts, they're absolutely done in good taste. By that I mean that I do not make fun of the instrument, of the violin, and I do not make fun of music. I only make fun of myself. I don't try to play badly. I try to play as good as I can. If it comes out lousy, I can't help it. But I don't deliberately do it. Well, you saw, you know, I try to play good.
It's terrible.
You know, he tried to pay me a compliment in Seattle, you see, and he said to me, he says, you know, Jack, you play the violin much better than I thought you did. So I wanted to be modest, and I said to him, Mr. Samuel, because I didn't call him then by his first name, I said, Mr. Samuel, I said, no, I says, I'm sure that there isn't a violin player in your orchestra who doesn't play the violin better than I do. He says, yes, and that includes my clarinet player. So I said to him, how long has he been taking violin lessons? He says, he starts tomorrow with this thing. What? Huh? Oh, wait a minute. All right, but I understand they want to ask questions. Is that right? People want to ask me some questions. Do you have something to say?
Yeah, I got something.
All right. Then you can ask me some
questions. I want to introduce two of Jack's people that are with him. One you just saw over here, which is Irving Fine, who's Jack's manager and been with him some 17 or 18 years. Mr. Irving Fine. Mr. Herrick, his musical...
Merrick.
Merrick, his musical director, is right over there. 30 years.
Yeah.
And now we will open it up.
All right.
It is a press conference, too.
Well, I forgot. I kept talking. That's why I asked if I was talking too long, and I forgot. I talked so much, I forgot this was a press conference. But maybe they get a lot of things out of just talking like this, you know. But I'd be very happy to answer any questions about anything, you know. Doesn't have to be just the concerts. Anything I know about, you know, if you start asking me about Vietnam, this I know nothing. Who's got a cigar? I got one.
Jack, you haven't told them actually how much they're taking in, and maybe they'd like to know.
Oh, already they got that?
Yeah.
Already they've taken in here. This is unbelievable. I can't get over it. $121,000 for this one night. How about that?
While he's on that one, I'd like to say that Safeway Stores and the Oakland Tribune have underwritten all the expenses in connection with this entire thing. This has been a great service.
You know what's kind of sad about this to me? I'll tell you what it is. You know, I've been doing these concerts for 8 years for nothing. See? Now I thought next year, because this was supposed to have been, this year was supposed to have been my last year for weekly television shows. I was just going to do some specials. But contractually, I had to go on for one more year, you see. So next year, I intend only to do a few specials. Then I thought, gee, I'd like to devote the whole time, the whole year, to giving concerts and still make it a benefit, but as long as I'm not going to do anything else, to get a salary for this. You know, like $5,000 a concert. Well, that wouldn't hurt if you make $121,000 or $60,000 or $70,000 to give me $5,000 a concert. And then, unfortunately, I've worked up this image now of being such a nice guy for doing him for nothing that if you took in $300,000, I can't charge you a dime for it. All I get is my hotel expenses, and boy, do I charge him for telephone calls. You've never seen anything like it. Yes, I want a light, and then I want to answer some questions. If there are any questions that the press wants to know.
They're right here.
Huh?
Well, Mr. Benny, if Isaac Stern were in town Wednesday and you sent him two tickets, would he attend your concert?
Yes, and you know why he would attend? Now, here's a fella who knows all about the concerts that practically started around with him, and yet he has never seen one of the... He's only... watched a rehearsal. He watched a rehearsal once at Carnegie Hall, and then the concert that I gave with him, which was on television at Carnegie Hall when we played the Bach double concerto together. And so he would come.
John, you know, weren't you instrumental in saving Carnegie Hall?
Was yes, you're darn right I was. I was part of that, saving Carnegie Hall. You know? And... Isaac, the night we did that concert, we played the Bach double concerto, and at rehearsal there must have been about 100 people sitting in the audience, and I had been practicing this Bach concerto, but Isaac, who hadn't looked at it for years, played it with me for the first time, and suddenly everything stopped, so I thought I did something wrong. So I said, what happened? Isaac said, I made the mistake. Well, I ran over and kissed him in front of 100 people. Imagine Isaac made the mistake, not me.
Are any of your grandchildren taking violin lessons?
No, they're taking piano lessons. I'm trying to convince the kids that the instrument that everybody is sorry they didn't take up when they grow older is the piano. See, when you take up a violin or a cello or any other instrument, then you better make a business of it, you see. But when you take up a piano, then you have your own fun, and the better you can play, the better you like it. So I'd like to see them take up the piano. I don't think I could make a living with just playing the violin any place. But maybe I could have, because when I was a little kid and studied, I was a pretty good fiddler, and I stopped practicing when I was 15 years old, and then I never touched the fiddle except to play Love and Bloom for 47 years until I decided to give concerts, and that's when I started to practice. Imagine me trying to move these fingers.
How much do you practice?
Now? Oh, I try to practice an hour or 2 hours a day.
Do you?
Yeah. May not sound like that when you hear it, but that's what I, you know. And you know why I practice? not to improve, so I'm not worse than the last concert. You know, you have to practice even to play badly. Well, you know, she used to make me practice in the bathroom, you know. In the toilet, really, is where I had to. And she always kept the doors locked because there's nothing as bad as hearing somebody practice. And I don't care if it's Isaac Stern or Heifetz, because you do not practice for tone or anything. You just practice and bear down and scratch and practice to strengthen your fingers. So it sounds awful. And if the ladies will all leave the room, I'll tell the gentleman what my wife said to me about my violin playing. Right now, I won't do it. Remind me to tell you later. And my wife is a very nice lady and doesn't use that kind of language, but this time she did. Well, since I have been giving concerts, I like to listen to only, well, I won't just say only, but most of the time, just the classics and good music. And I go to a lot of concerts now that I didn't go to before. In fact, I never realized I liked music that much until I actually went into it myself.
How does Phil Harris feel about this?
Huh?
Oh,
Phil, he was my orchestra leader for 17 years, and he didn't even know the names of the different instruments. Phil Harris used to conduct for me for 15 years, I think it was, and he didn't know one note of music. Now, I don't know, but you could mention any patent medicine, he'd tell you how much alcohol it contained. You know? He knew nothing about me, and I didn't know that, you know. 15 years he conducted the orchestra. When they'd stop playing, he'd put down the stick. That's all he knew about it. Oh, he's with me. Frankie Remley has been with me. He came with me with Phil Harris. Irving, how long ago did Phil Harris' orchestra join me? In about 37, 1937. Remley came with him. And then when Phil left and went to do his own show, Remley stayed with the orchestra with me, and he's still with me. He drinks, too, quite a bit, Remley. I used to do a gag about Remley, the kind of a funny gag about the fact that he drinks an awful lot. And one day he went down, he gave a pint of blood to the Red Cross. But unfortunately, they couldn't give it to anybody under 21. Yes. I have two real good violins with me. One is a Stradivarius and a real good Strad. I mean, it's just not an ordinary Strad. Then I have another violin, which is called a Presenda, which is one of the best of that kind. Mine is not one of the best Strads in price, and there are probably a lot of Strads better than mine, but mine is an awfully good one and worth a lot more than I paid for it. And I wouldn't sell it for a lot more than I paid for it. In fact, I couldn't sell it now because I willed both violins to the Los Angeles Philharmonic. So I can't give it. Now I can't sell it at all.
Where did you come by
it? Huh?
Where did you buy it?
I bought it from a dealer in Los Angeles who got it from a woman who owned it in New York. And it's in the list of Stradivarius violins. And it was made in 1729. Bob Hope sent a wire to Seattle when I opened and said that he knows that I have a real Strad because I was there while they were making it at the time.
Well,
politics, what do you think of the Hollywood influence in politics today?
Well, how do you mean, how do you mean that? You mean...
Mr. Murphy, Mr. Reagan.
Well, I think Murphy will make a very good senator. I really do, for some reason or other, even though he was in show business, that shouldn't make any difference. He's very sincere, I think. I think he'll be a good senator, and I have no business to sway people when I don't think I know enough about it, about who would be the better president or the better senator. You see? But I think when an actor is so interested in politics that he thinks he knows, that he has every right to get up and talk and try to sway people, which at least shows that his country comes first and his business second. A lot of people think they have no business to talk or try to. I think they have, if they know what they're talking about. Now, some get up just to talk, don't know what they're talking about. Then they have no business to do it. I know I wouldn't know enough about it. Or you should know an awful lot about it before you get up and try to really sway people in your direction.
Are these benefit concerts hurting your image as a fool man?
Well, no, because I think they accept this on the just as a television show, although a lot of people do ask, friends of mine, if I am really a little bit stingy, because they figure where there's smoke, there's fire, you know. And a funny, I want them to think that I am a little bit, so therefore I don't care too much about publicity, about charities and money that I give out to this and that, and all the charities that I, the charitable affairs that I participate in, because I want them to think a little bit, you know, that maybe I am a little bit stingy, because I think it's funnier I must tell you something that happened here in San Francisco, and I can tell you, because we're not going over the air now, are we? Huh? If we were going on television, I couldn't tell this. But, huh? This isn't live, is it?
No, it's not live. You're on tape.
Well, okay, they can cut this.
Because
I got to tell you this. I have to tell you this because it goes to show you what can happen. A thing that wouldn't mean anything to anybody else, but if it happens to me, it becomes so funny. I gave a concert in San Francisco about 4 or 5 years ago, whenever it was. And I'm living at the Fairmont Hotel, and Irving is with me. And they picked us up early in the morning to take us to the airport to leave for Los Angeles. Now, I get down in the lobby, and excuse me, I had to go to the little boy's room. So I went. I came back, and we're in the car going to the airport, and I felt in my back pocket, and I saw that my checkbook was missing. Now, losing a checkbook isn't important, but you always have cards in there that are important or notes. So I said to Irving, I said, who was with me, and I said, I think I left my checkbook up in my room. Have we got time to go back to the hotel? And the driver said yes. So we go back to the hotel. I go up into my room, and there's no checkbook. Then I thought, I wonder, could I have dropped it in the men's room? I said, I'll go back and see. Now, this is, so help me God, is a true story. Now, you got to put in a dime, you know, to get in. So I look in my pocket. Oh, when I first went in the men's room, I had a dime and a quarter. So I used up the dime, you know. Now I go back, and you know the little open space at the bottom of the doors. So I look under where I was, and I see my checkbook. Now, I go in my pocket to get another dime out, and it's early in the morning, and all I've got is a quarter. See? Now, I don't want to run all the way up to get changed, so I get down on my hands and knees, and I start to crawl into the place, and so help me God, a guy walks in and catches me crawling out, and when I got out, he recognized me right away. And I had to take an oath and swear to this guy. And I made him bend down and look that my checkbook is in there. And finally, I asked him if he had changed for a quarter, and he laughed. He said, no, but here's a dime. And go in and get your checkbook. Now, you know, this would not be a funny story about anybody else, would it? But to happening to me, that looked like I was trying to sneak in there without paying a dime, you know? You know, you could almost tell that on TV. Not quite, but...
Mr. Benny, why did you stop studying the violin?
When I was a kid? Well, I studied till I was about 15, and then I went into vaudeville with a piano player. We did a violin piano act. And in fact, we played right here in Oakland with it before the First World War. And then I stopped practicing. And I wouldn't touch the violin except to play the little junk we played, you know, in the act. And I was going to continue to practice, but when I got into the Navy, I was put in a sailor show. And we were put in what we call the Navy Relief Society, which was entertainment for the Navy in which they made money. And they put us in a show, and I was supposed to do the violin and piano act with a fellow called Zez Confrey, who was a popular pianist at the time. And the author needed somebody to do just one or two comedy lines to play the part of the orderly, of an orderly to an admiral. And he picked anybody at random. And he just looked over my way, says, hey, you, young fella, come over here. See? So I walked over, he says, let's see if you can do this. So I read the line a couple of times. He liked the way I read them, and I came back the next day to rehearsal, and he had some more parts for me. And by the time our sailor show opened, I had the comedy part of the show. So I thought, well, gee, if I can be a comedian, I'll drop the fiddle. You see? So I dropped the fiddle and just carried it in my arms and didn't play it very much. And this is how I became a comedian. Now, I may never have been one if this guy hadn't picked me out of the crowd there, you know? Because I was frightened to talk before on the stage. Everything we do on television and radio came by accident. I happened to say well once when Don Wilson did some line bawling me out about something. I said, well, and suddenly it got such a big laugh that we kept doing it, and suddenly it became established. Everything started by an accident. They say, how'd you start being stingy? Started by a few jokes, only meaning it to last one performance. And then it built up. My theme song, Love and Bloom, a theme song that I hate, but I could do nothing about it, became my theme song because I used the number a lot. The famous feud I had with Fred Allen, all started with just Fred making some remark, which I talk about, incidentally, during the concert, about some remark about me. Derogatory remark, in which I answered him the next week, then he answered me, then I answered him, and we were into this feud for 8 months before we even got together to discuss it. You see? Now, you know very well that if Fred Allen and I, or any two comedians, got together and said, let's have a feud, it wouldn't last 2 weeks because it would be so contrived. So this was all done by... Everything has been done, just started by accident. And we were just evidently smart enough to keep it up, I guess. But if anybody'd ever told me 29, 30 years ago that your being stingy is going to pay off 30 years from now, I'd have thought they're crazy, you know. But it's the easiest characterization to get laughs out of, being stingy. Because everybody's family, everybody at home watching, always has somebody like that. They got an Uncle Ben or a Cousin John or somebody that's stingy. So the character stays all the time.
Have you ever figured out how much you've raised for all of these, during all these concerts or symphony arts?
Well, we've raised around $4 million, isn't it? I bet he's got it, too.
Just happened to have it. With Blue Portland, we raised $3,569,000.
Yeah. But, don't forget, this was not all the musicians. The musicians was about half of that, wasn't it? Because this, don't forget, this started with the... City of Hope and those and the Israel Bond thing, and so, but I would say about almost about $1.5 million easily for the orchestras, and I'm not through yet. You know what? Everybody, you know, they give you so much credit. You know, everybody has a selfish motive in what they do. Even Bob Hope and I discussed it once about all the credit we got. And Bob got so much for going overseas, entertaining troops, and I get a lot of credit. I got a lot of credit for that, too, and for these. Believe me, if we didn't have fun doing it, we couldn't do it. I have more fun giving concerts than any television show I've ever done or any radio show. And you know, it's true with most people, some extracurricular thing that they do, which they don't even get paid for, they have more fun out of it. And we had fun when we went overseas entertaining troops. We had fun every place we went. And we saw places that we would never see during peacetime. Now, who would go to Korea during peacetime? But we went, played all those little towns in Korea, you know, and where the troops were. I don't mean by that, I don't recommend a war so that I can travel for nothing. I don't mean that, but I mean if you have to go, you like doing it or you wouldn't do it. I love giving these concerts or I couldn't do it. I have more fun with this than anybody.
What about the effect of your concerts, particularly your appearances on television, in exposing a lot of people to good music that might not otherwise hear it?
I didn't quite get that one.
Well, presumably a lot of people have watched you play that have never been in a concert hall or would never otherwise go to a concert, isn't that right?
Yes. Well, what I'm hoping for, that a lot of people will come who have never been to a concert, and then listening to the first half, you know, that I'm not in, realize suddenly that they like good music. And will continue going to concerts. In fact, this does more good than actually the money that they take in. Because, now for instance, we had a fellow traveling with us once, a friend of mine, who went to St. Louis with me. St. Louis, Detroit, and Rochester, New York, where I gave 3 concerts. He had never been to a concert in his life. He was the last guy in the world you think would like a concert. So in St. Louis, he went right at the start. 8 o'clock, he was sitting there. He said, for once, he's going to see a concert. He went so nuts about good music that the other 2 concerts, he was there the first half and goes to concerts now all the time, quite often. Now, I always hope that there are a lot of people that'll come in out of curiosity to see me and will catch the first half, of course, and then find out, gee, I didn't know I liked music so much. I remember they had to drag me to go to the ballet for the first time. And then I liked it and went quite often after that. Now they're going to have to drag me again, but I mean I liked it at the time.
You've had a lot of money for the Maxwell copy, too.
Huh?
For the Maxwell.
Yeah, it's too bad they're not in existence now. I could have been part of that company.
You're well,
speaking of your vaudeville days, do you look back on those with any nostalgia?
Not with nostalgia, but I liked vaudeville. It was a great school for entertainers and for comedians. It's kind of a school that you don't have now. That's why it's kind of tough for a lot of newcomers, although a lot of them are making it now. But in those days, we had a chance really to study delivery, timing, improve in material, know what's good, what's bad. Vaudeville did it, burlesque did it. But I don't care about the old days, and I must truthfully say, you know, my daughter said something once that'll answer this. She was on a Johnny Carson show. She was on to plug one of my concerts. And Johnny Carson, who likes me very, very much and thinks that I look very young, you know. And he said to my daughter once, he said, Joni, he says, now I know how old your dad is, but I don't know, he seems like such a young fella and he walks young and he acts that way. He certainly doesn't act his age. And I know he mingles with young people all the time, but he doesn't. He seems so much younger than he actually is. How do you account for this? And I'm sitting home waiting to hear what her answer's going to be. And then she brought up this point. She says, well, I think one of the reasons is he likes to work all the time. And he's not interested in what happened years ago or if people tell him that he was great on radio. He said, the hell with that. That scorn. He's only interested in what happened last week or this week and what's going to be in the future. And she said, I think that keeps him young, and I think that's a very smart answer, actually. You know, I think it keeps everybody young who feels that way.
It's close to home, doesn't it?
Huh?
I got one like it.
No, sure you do. You can't. There's an old fella whom you all know the name, Adolf Zucker, who is about 90 years old, and he comes to our club 2-3 days a week for lunch, 90 years old. And all he talks about is the motion picture industry of the future. He doesn't talk about what happened. The only time he goes back to years ago with William Hart and Tom Mix and all those guys is if you happen to ask him, then he'll get into that. Otherwise, he never mentions it. So I really don't care about what happened. If everybody says, gee, you had great shows 2 years ago, I can't help that. If I haven't got good shows this year, that isn't going to help me that I had good shows 2 years ago. I had a fellow try to pay me a compliment once, a stagehand. He really thought this was a compliment. He said, Mr. Benny, do you mind if I say something flattering to you? And he wasn't kidding. I said, well, certainly I don't. What is it? He says, you know, I like you much better in radio than I do on television. And here the fellow thought he was paying me a compliment. So finally I said to him, but what good would that be now? Supposing I had a good show on radio now. You know, what would happen with it? Nothing.
Time for one more question, if
yeah.
we may.
All right.
Comedians always praise your sense of timing. Is this purely an intuitive thing? How would you account for this ability to...
About timing?
Yeah.
Well, I think every good comedian has good timing. Otherwise, he couldn't get along. He wouldn't be where he is if he didn't have timing. Now, some may be... let's say, passé in material. They might not know good material from bad material. There are some comedians like that. There are some who are not in good taste and some that are in good taste. And taste, strangely enough, has absolutely nothing to do with ability. I know some of the cleverest people who can say the most wonderful things, and yet they'll always say something wrong. It'll either be off color or something that shouldn't have been said, might be some racial thing or something. For some reason they haven't got, and this has nothing to do with ability. He can be the greatest comedian or the greatest entertainer in the world, and taste has nothing to do with that. Or he can be bad and not such a good comedian and have real good taste. But timing, every comedian better have that, or he has no chance at all. This he's got to have, and everybody has it. I may talk a lot slower than somebody else. It doesn't fit somebody else. I know by the time Milton Berle does 10 minutes, it would last me a season. He does so many jokes in 10 minutes that I would just about get two jokes out, you know? Everybody thinks I think I have good time because I take my time. I'll tell you why I think a lot of people think I have good timing, and Bob Hope has mentioned this so many times. Of course, Bob and I are very dear friends, really next to George Burns. I think Bob and I are about the closest friend I have. We like each other very much, both professionally and socially. But Bob thinks the thing he likes about it, he says that one thing about Jack, he's not afraid to wait. He's not afraid. He doesn't think he has to get a laugh every time he opens his mouth. He thinks if it's interesting talk, you can wait for a laugh. And you can talk and take your time. Now, most of them are afraid, you know, and they're afraid they got to get the next joke right away, because if they don't laugh here, my God, you know, you think you're going to throw them out of show business. Well, I don't feel that way about it. I take my time, and when the laugh's supposed to be there, I get it there some way. But my timing is most of the big comedians have equally good timing in their own way. Well, you remember what Chevalier said of the alternative. I'm going to keep on going if I can. My plans for the future is to do what I'm doing, but do it a little bit differently if I can. And that is to do a stage show again, like one of my reviews. I did 6 weeks at the Ziegfeld Theater in New York. I just did in Australia for a month. A little review that started at, like something similar to what Chevalier does, except I have a few people with me. Or maybe a stage play, do a few television shows, a lot of concerts. I'll find myself very, very busy, whether I do the weekly television show or not. And strangely enough, the easiest thing I have is the weekly television show. That's a cinch. I work about 3 days a week. And we figured out one day about how many hours I actually work on television. I work about 13 hours a week, and that's all. We have it very easy. I don't go, half the time I don't bother with the rehearsals even. I stay home and try to learn my lines, and that's it. So I think I'll keep going. I hope to, anyway.
Well, Jack, you've been very generous with your time, and we've all had the privilege of listening not only to one of America's great entertainers, but to a great citizen. Thanks very much.